So this is part two of the teleconference on the Observer Self, August 8th, 2009. And in terms of tools and techniques for developing the Observer Self, the daily review is one of the best. Let me talk about some qualities that the Observer Self probably needs to represent for you. I say probably because everyone has a different set of priorities and a different characterology, and this is a decision that you will need to make. The Observer Self is intended to be neutral, not involved in the outcome of a situation. Any voice you hear that says we must do this or we have to do that without a rational overtone to it is probably not the voice of the Observer Self. Observer Self needs to be non-judgmental. It may state that something is a problem, but the difference is it doesn't say that you are the problem. Now, in terms of non-judgmental, I have another example here of discerning the difference between various voices that you hear. It's beginning to sound like we're all schizophrenic, but sorry about constant references to voices, but I remember that I had started studying pathwork and I had started getting some of these ideas, and I was driving in the car in Los Angeles on the freeway, and I did a lane change that cut someone off, and I gave myself a hard time. I was very harsh with myself. I did notice the first thing I tried to do was defend it and say, well, they deserved it, or they were this, or they were that. But that doesn't fly. So then I turned around and said, you always do that, and you're in a hurry, and you've done it again. And at that particular moment, what I heard from some part of me that I do not remember having been aware of before was a voice that said, would you behave that way to anyone else who did that? And I was absolutely nonplussed. I was speechless. Again, I don't know where this voice came from, but I had never heard a voice inside me that was so clear and so supportive and proposing to me that under my own value system, I had violated myself. And the truth is, no, I would not have made such a nasty and venomous comment to anyone else who had simply made a bad judgment about changing a lane in traffic, that I was dumping on myself with a lot of criticism and vitriol far beyond the situation, that I would not do to anyone else. And what I heard in hearing that voice, what I heard was an invitation that I deserved to treat myself with as much courtesy as I would treat anyone else. It was a major turning point for me in realizing how harshly I criticized myself about the smallest of details. And in that moment of hearing the voice with its simple phrase, and I'll repeat it again, all the voice said was, would you criticize anyone else like that? It was a simple question. And the simple answer was no. I don't value treating someone that badly. And the invitation was left up to me. That was the end of the dialogue. The invitation was left up to me. Well, then what are we going to do about it? How about becoming nicer to Jan? And that's what I mean by the Observer Self voice. To not presume that there's a serious problem, to ask questions, to invite dialogue, to call up from you the positive parts of you, the parts that say, no, I don't treat anyone like that, and I would never treat anyone else like that, oops, except me. That's calling forward from you the positive part of you. Observer Self needs to be able to step back. And by that I mean if the lines get blurry and you start feeling that the Observer Self is getting invested, the Observer Self voice itself needs to be able to back off and see a larger picture. Observer self needs to be real about the greater spiritual task. And this is the quote that I read from 189 about the spiritual task of human beings includes bringing negative aspects in with them for the purpose of transformation. Being real about this means, of course, we have negative aspects. And of course, they would be significant, not easily transformed. These might be things that we're going to be carrying through the majority of our life before we finally tie them down. Being real about this is saying we have a lifetime task in front of us. Where are we on the task? What kind of movement are we making? Are we making any progress at all? Are we seeing more deeply? Are we understanding the issues more thoroughly? Where are we? That is the voice of the objective observer, rather than telling us that we have missed the mark, that we're not good enough, or we're never going to fix this because it's been around for 50 years and I guess we're just never going to get rid of it. That's the defeatist voice. The observer self needs to be truthful. So if you hear a voice that exaggerates a situation or over-dramatizes a situation, that would not be the voice of the observer self. Observer self needs to be open to real love. Real love meaning not soliciting our weaknesses, not trying to rationalize, not trying to cover up, not trying to pretend that things are better than they are. Real love is sometimes expressed through the very harsh act of telling the truth, even though there are a lot of feelings about that truth. And the observer self needs to be just slightly individuated from the ego. So when, again, I speak to you, I am not my observer self, because I am the part that is making up the sentences and deciding what to say and constructing this. My observer self would not be involved in the construction of anything. So the observer self, you can say what it says, but it does not speak with the I voice. So that, I didn't really cover a daily review. I felt a little guilty about it because I keep going on and on about daily review. But there's a reason why I do that. Daily review is the cheapest, easiest way to determine what might be going on in your life all by yourself. You don't need anyone's help. You don't need a pad and paper if your memory is good enough. If you're not trying to dodge the reality and you list things in your head and you remember them from day to day, you don't even need to write them down. The daily review is a way of putting down observations in paper or in memory so that you can see trends, so that you can assist in your own analysis of what's going on in your life. Let me give you an example. If you believe that you are a very angry person, that's a judgment. I'm a very angry person. How do you know that? Well, I get angry all the time. Okay. How about you start tracking every time you get angry? What if you just make a quick list, very, very short list? Once again, I don't want to spend a lot of time in daily review, but I've got a lot of materials on the website, and I've talked at length about it. But you make a very brief list of statements about what happened and what made you angry. And what you're trying to find when you do that is a pattern. What kinds of things make you angry? Because the truth is, some anger is good. Some anger is justified. Anger itself is simply a feeling. You may be talking about rage rather than anger. And you'll notice rage because rage always blames. Rage shoots out. Anger simply is. So looking at the data review can help you differentiate between anger and rage. Looking at the data at your data review can help you see that you're angry about specific topics. And then you'll need to look at those topics and see where they lead you. Are you angry at authority figures? Are you angry because you have a feeling of hopelessness? What are you angry about? Because sometimes when we have a lot of feelings moving up, we cannot discern the quality of those feelings, the characteristics of those feelings, and where they come from. So it's important to know, what are you feeling? How often are you feeling it? What is the feeling about in your mind? You know, what is your concept of what it's about? And then adding all these things up, what is the trend? In general, what makes you angry? You could even look at what makes you happy, just to see that there's another aspect to this, that there's another half going on. Because sometimes we can actually forget. We can say, I get angry all the time, and you make a list, and you're not. You're angry a few times a day, but that anger colors your entire day. It's very useful to see that feelings of anger only come up a few times. You can still address them, but just seeing that there are only two or three incidents a day can shift your attitude from the sense, I am an angry person, and that's a problem, to, there's a lot of anger going on. Something may be upsetting me. And beginning to look at what the underlying causes might be for that anger. So that's daily review, in a nutshell. The other thing I thought I would touch on is I've been doing a lot of homework and a lot of thought about self-led groups. There are a number of people who have been asking questions about self-led groups. And I put some thoughts about this in the newsletter that I put out for August. And I found this presentation of the Observer Self to be very instructive for me to kind of get my head around what is the Observer Self and what are the needs of it. And so, without having answers for you, without having a plan and a program and, you know, seven bullet points to make all groups function well, my observation is that just like an individual needs to have a positive, functional observer self, groups of people need this as well. Now, when a group is facilitated or when there's leadership, that is, to some extent, what we expect from our leaders. We expect them to hold a wider perspective so that we can do our part and not have to worry about the whole. That's part of leadership, is holding the wider perspective. But when a group forms and there is no definable leadership and everyone is working at their own pace and in their own particular way, what can happen is nobody stands guard. Nobody stands point over the issues the group is concerned about. Now, if one person does, on some level, even if that's a relatively passive activity without a lot of authority and decision-making control, that person to some degree becomes the de facto leader of that group, if they are holding a key element that the group needs to know about. And so with a group without a leader, where one person doesn't want to volunteer and take that position and learn on the job, one of the useful things to do is to have all members work on holding some quality of observer self for the group in its task. Now, it may sound kind of confusing, but what I'm presenting is that just like I may have a lot of different voices in me, and I need to discern the objective observer. I need to develop that voice. I need to hear that voice and adjust if necessary so that that voice is coming from a nice, clear, clean, loving, supportive place. So the group needs or all the objective observer selves in the group, who also look at group issues. Where are we going? What are we doing? Are we wasting too much time? What is our purpose? Is our purpose being met? The equivalent of taking notes and doing a laundry list after different meetings, saying, these are the places that we fell down. What can we do about it? We fell down here the last three times. What can we do about the structure of the group? What can we do about discussion within the group so that we become more functional, that we align more with our mission and our task? And again, if you can see that this is coming from a place of support and love, where you want to be able to see what's going on, but without judging the group as immature or a problem, of seeing it as a work in progress, just like the Observer Self chapter is inviting us to see ourselves as a work in process. So that we can say to the group, what do we all want to do? And presuming you have a positive group that wishes to work together and wishes to get something done, then there are answers to those questions. And then there's feedback periodically. Well, we're not doing that. What do we have to do about that? So developing an observer self for a group can help make a group self-responsible, and it creates an authority within the group that holds the group's needs rather than an individual. Now, of course, no one person, as I said, would be holding this. You almost have to round table it. So it's a complicated thing, but this may be one of the elements that self-led groups sometimes don't develop and don't have. And so when the group tends to go off the rails, when members talk a lot out of nervousness, that there's no place where an individual can say, what are we doing? What is our purpose? Have we gone off track? And what happens is that we watch a group tend to wander off and become dysfunctional, and it upsets us and concerns us because we probably care about the mission of the group. And so in reaching out and saying, wait a minute, this is not the observer self doing that. This is an invested part of us, a part of us that has an agenda, that wants something done, that wants to bring us back from the brink of becoming dysfunctional. What I'm speaking of here is finding the observer self that can offer observations to the group cleanly, lovingly, and supportive. So this is a place where the concept of the observer self, when applied to the individual, and then you have a group of individuals, and all of them are working on it, that can be also applied to the group. And in that way, you have two levels to learn on, the group level and the individual level. That's about all I had on the observer self. I can pick up some things from the... There's a whistle in the background for one of you. If you hear the whistle, could you press star 6 so that we don't hear that? If anyone has any questions, I'm open to that.
Jan, I have a question. It's Josie.
Sure, Josie. What is it?
It's hard to make the distinction between the ego and the observer self for me. And what I'm thinking about now is, say the three chair type interchange, where you have the child and the lower self, and then you have the ego, and then you're bringing the higher self in.
Mm-hmm.
Where does the observer self fit in there? If, say, in that case, the ego is doing the work sort of as the point guard between the parts. It's a hard distinction to make.
What I find when I work with the three-chair meditation, it can be sometimes very, very useful to focus one of the chairs on the observer self itself.
Oh.
Okay, so let me tell you why this can be useful. When you speak right now, you are speaking from an I. I sometimes can't distinguish.
Mm-hmm.
So we got that. We know that you're speaking from the I. Okay?
Right.
But if you're willing to do this for just a second, when you say, I have a hard time distinguishing the observer self, what happens if you then ask the observer self and wait for an answer? What kind of answer do you get in your own internal sensory perception? Is there, let me put it this way, not to put you on the hot spot. Do you feel something? Do you have a sense that there's a part of you that may not be used to answering that question, but has the answer?
Yes, I definitely get the energetic sense of that.
Okay.
It's out there. It heard me, it definitely heard me ask the question.
Right. That's your observer self. Okay? Part of developing the observer self is giving it a voice. Perfect, allowing it to speak, and it's not going to speak perfectly the first three sentences. Why would it? So, let me give you another example. I was listening to a tape this afternoon of Pat Rodegast, who channels Emmanuel, and she was explaining as Pat what it's like to channel Emmanuel. And she says it's very hard work because I need to be exquisitely attuned to what that voice says, and I have to do my very, very best to transmit it without adding any of me to it. That same process is what it can feel like to, in effect, channel the observer self.
Okay, I got it. That's a great example because I can get that.
Right. Fabulous. And yes, it does sound a little murky. About three-quarters of the way into this, I'm going, ooh, voices, schizophrenia, crazy lady. You know, it can sound a bit overwrought sometimes to be talking about all these voices, which is why it's easier in workshops to actually put people on the couch and say, now speak your observer, now speak this, now speak that, because we can hear the voices, but again, we're not used to it. So it's as if, I remember that one of the cute stories in the little movie, What the Bleep Do We Know? One of the stories was about Indians in South America, and when the Westerners came and anchored their ships in the harbor, the Indians didn't see the ships. They had never seen a ship before. They had no context for it. They simply visually didn't see it. What they saw was the longboat when it came up on the beach. And I'm presuming this was all translated back to the Westerners who brought the story back. And so from the Indians' perspective, there is no such thing as a ship. There's no word for a ship. And all of a sudden, there were these white men standing on our beach in a rowboat. We understand rowboats. But when we look out into the harbor, we still can't quite rock ship. We don't know what to do with that visual stimuli. That's what it can feel like the first time you try to identify the observer self. It can feel like you're trying to address a muscle that has never twitched before, and you've got to figure out how to make it wiggle. The truth is, it has been wiggling, but you have not been conscious of it.
Now, do we go so far as to say that the observer self also observes the higher self?
Yes. For instance, when I do the three-chair meditation, and what we're talking about is there's a lecture, Lecture 182, which has a nickname, and it's a meditation for three voices, and when we do the exercise, we have people sit in three different positions or chairs so that you actually physically move a little bit. Another way to understand this, a great way to work with this kind of material, is voice dialogue. There's an energetic difference when we move from higher self to lower self, to observer to ego, we can hear, we can see the energy. Okay? So when you do the three-chair meditation and you say, you know, this is the lower self, well, the voice that is speaking is the I. All right, you've already got confusion here, because the lower self itself doesn't have a verbal voice. It's an energy. Okay? So when you are trying to find out what the lower self part of you thinks, you're already putting in an interpreter. You're putting the I in as the interpreter. The objective observer will be the part of you that says, this doesn't sound right. This, I'm identifying this as lower self energy, but this actually sounds like an angry child. Angry child is different from lower self. So when I use this exercise to try to bring consciousness to the different qualities within us, it's a very subtle nuance, but you can tell the difference. And one of the ways you tell the difference is you already have an active observer self, and it's the part that's saying, this isn't quite right. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, because that takes that piece out where you, when you're questioning, is that really my ego, or which part of me is that? Who is actually, you know, the tricky ego could sort of take over. But now we have the observer self out there questioning.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ego can't really get away with anything. So it really distinguishes that outside part that doesn't have the judgment about anything. It's just merely observing and stating the facts, if I'm understanding correctly.
Yes. And like I say, oddly enough, as complicated as this may have sounded, and I may have overcomplicated it for all I know, but as complicated as this explanation may sound, when you actually do the work, when you actually try to find your observer self, it's easier than you would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So again, if you identify that the part of you that is forming the words and asking the question is an active part, well, then that's not the observer self. There's a part of you that perhaps is, and I'm inventing this, this is not, well, I didn't sense this in your energy field. There could be a part of you that's embarrassed and upset because you have a question, but you don't know how to ask it properly. And that part might be drumming its heels and very upset. Well, that's not the observer self. There could be a part of you that says, I'm too big to ask a question like that, and basically it's got its nose in the air. That's not the observer self. There's a place where you can, like peeling a banana or peeling an artichoke, where once you determine that a voice is invested or judgmental or full of feeling or emotion, that's not it. That at some point you're going to tap into a voice that is crystal clear, and it's like smacking a glass and hearing the ring. It is much easier than we imagine. But that first reaching out for the voice can feel very, very difficult. Think of it like riding a bike for the first time. It involves a sense of balance that you may never before have used, and few people can do that within 1 minute. But almost everybody can become mildly competent over a period of time. That's all? Okay. So are there any other questions?
Jan, this is Leah. I think the question that was just asked and answered, for me, still is not totally clear from a standpoint of the three voice or three chair meditation, simply because the way I understand that exercise, the ego that sits, the ego does observe, and observe the lower self and invites the higher self. So I wonder if the term adult ego can help explain this, and how do you see the relationship between the adult ego and their observer self?
I agree that I didn't complete the question, so it's good to keep going on this. What I am saying is it's just not that simple, that the three-chair meditation is more complex than we give it credit for. That when we split into three parts, the three parts are still speaking through the ego, whether or not you're addressing the ego directly. You've already got an overlay of ego on all three parts. And that you have the potential for holding the observer self in all three parts as well. Now, if you don't have a well-developed observer self, that's what I'm suggesting is you may need to practice hearing that voice clearly, because you may not need that voice during that particular three-chair meditation. You may want to simply hear the lower self. And what I was suggesting is that the observer self comes in to play here when we, and you're a helper, so I know that you know what I'm talking about. When you're working with clients and you know that the voice isn't right, you know they're confusing lower self with child, you know that they think it's lower self, but it's actually angry adult, that hearing that distinction, once you can show them by having them change chairs and go back and forth, once they get that, the part of them that gets that is the objective observer, as well as the ego. And it's just not that clean. We're just not Legos. We don't snap together. So that's why I think it's important to spend a fair amount of time working with the observer self even before we go into things like three-chair meditation. If you're doing three-chair meditation and these other voices come up, to be able to identify what the observer self might be saying. So in other words, I think I'm being verbose here. Please forgive me. When you do a three-chair meditation, sometimes you get other voices. And that it is the observer self, both in the facilitator who is doing the exercise or in the person doing the exercise, if they're doing it on their own, that can give us that information. Does that address it a little better?
Yes, but not complete, simply because it's complex. You're right, the Lego statement rings very true.
Yes.
And even in the guide's usage of the word ego that is used differently in different places in the lectures adds to that confusion, to that, you know, the definition is more tricky.
Yes. So I'm going to suggest that words are tools,
mm-hmm.
and that they are sometimes not appropriate for the job, but they are the best we've got,
mm-hmm.
including observer self.
Yeah.
So I agree. Perhaps I can't answer the question because the question is unanswerable.
Yeah. What I just want to make to clarify is what I'm saying. I have a lot easier time with the concept of observer self than I do sometimes with the word ego. That's the place where there's different ways of using it that can be confusing in other times. So. But just in bringing the three-voice meditation into the example brought another question for me. So
one of the ways that I like to think of the ego is that the ego is a bureaucrat and a traffic policeman. That the ego is the one that stands and decides what information comes in and what information goes out and what format it will take. So in the lecture 132, in the guide lecture 132, The Function of the Ego, it talks about having an overbearing, overblown ego that's trying to do too much instead of simply making decisions about what passes through and what comes in. The ego is trying to control instead of making a simple decision. It's trying to influence. And that's where the ego grows beyond its original, let's say, the original purpose of the ego. And it basically tries to become a player instead of a servant. And yes, it's very hard with id, super ego. There's a lot of different modalities that use similar words. But if you think of the ego as simply the center point for what comes in and what goes out, then when I speak to, when I speak right now, your ego might focus elsewhere and you don't hear me. That would be the ego because you didn't hear me. On the other hand, the ego might hear me. I'm using you as an example, but this is not about you. The ego might hear and can't get anybody else to do anything about it. We hear the information and there's apathy in terms of internal voices inside us. But these are the kinds of, these are the kinds of moments when you can differentiate and delineate and feel the difference. Let me use biology, because I find biology to be a brilliant metaphor for spirit. When you have a muscle that you have never used and you need to use it, it can feel like the nerves are cut because you theoretically send a signal down there, but you've never done that before. You have never addressed that muscle with an electrical impulse. So even if the electrical impulse gets there, the muscle doesn't know how to respond. It has not been trained to respond. And when it does respond, you don't understand the signal it's sending back in return. And yet, with a very small amount of effort, a therapist can work with you to get the muscle activated, to start tracing electrical signals, and programming yourself to send signals to a muscle, receive signals from, so that you can begin to actively use something that before was simply a piece of flesh. I tend to go for gross examples, so here I am in one of my gross examples. That's what delineating the ego and the observer self, all these different, that's what it feels like. Starting to realize that, and I can't think of a good example, but there are some motions that some people can do with their hands and other people can't. And when you practice, you're clumsy and you wiggle your fingers and they're going all over the place like a little kid trying to walk. But if you practice for an hour, you can gain some level of coordinated movement. When we ask from a place of ignorance, where we have never actually tried to do this, it can seem overwhelming. In the actual practice of it, here. So what I would like to suggest is, if there's any confusion about what this is, to simply practice hearing what goes on in your head and noticing the color or flavor of the different voices. And I'm speaking with some level of confidence. It's very dangerous to say this is what's going to happen with personal process. But across the board, what I find to be feedback about this is that the observer self has a tone or ring or energy to it that is crystal clear energetically without emotion and to some extent without feeling. It has compassion, but it is not invested in the feeling. So using that little differentiation, what I'm trying to present is that if you divide up into, kind of beating this into the ground, but I think it's important, you do a three-chair meditation on three voices, the ego is going to be speaking those voices. and some feedback can be gotten from the observer self as to whether these voices are clean and clear or whether there is confusion. Because after all, if we weren't confused about the three voices, we wouldn't have to do the exercise. So what may be happening is that we often use the observer self, but we have never identified it as a separate energy.
Right.
Once you identify this as a separate energy, that's part of the developmental process. You may be able to make it stronger, to make its voice more clear, and to be able to access it more easily. So are there any further questions? And I don't mind if this point goes on. Some of these things are very, very important, and just because there isn't an easy answer doesn't mean they're not important. And part of the work is to discuss it and hear an answer and say, that sucks, that's a terrible answer. And to continue to do the thought process, the thinking process on your own. It is not my intention to supply answers, but to perhaps generate discussion within you about whether this would be useful. So, if there aren't any other questions, we may be done.
Well, thanks, Jan. To me, a sign of a powerful workshop when you leave with more questions than you had when you started. So, thank you.
Thank you. Very much appreciated. So, thank all of you for joining me, and hope you have a lovely day. Or evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jen.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.